I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. Former Missouri Senator Claire McCaskill has parted ways with her seat in office, but not with politics completely. Before she left Congress, the senior senator fired off controversial tweets about the new class of lawmakers and admonished abortion rights advocates. Some say she's been harder on Democrats than on Donald Trump. Today, a special conversation with the former senator. I'll ask her about that somewhat contentious exit from the Capitol, and we'll take a few questions from callers, too. We'll also explore the 12 years she spent representing Missourians in Washington and what she thinks about the future of the Democratic Party. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. In the blink of an eye, Claire McCaskill has moved from her standing as senior senator from the state of Missouri to everyday citizen. But she left office after giving a string of interviews in which she admonished abortion rights activists, took on those who wished she would be more critical of the president, and questioned all the attention lavished on freshman Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. She also pointed out that Republican senators privately think that President Trump is nuts. Senator Claire McCaskill joins us now for a special edition of Up to Date. We've got her for the hour, and away we go. Senator, welcome. Great to have you with us.
Go Chiefs.
Go Chiefs, absolutely. What's your prediction?
It just makes us all so nervous. You know, we've all been, you know, we've seen what happened this year. We've seen them overcome the odds at times. It appeared they couldn't. This kid's amazing. The quarterback, but we always have this playoff problem.
Yes,
and
yes, we do.
So tomorrow, I hope, is the day that we overcome that. I think it'll be close, but I think it'll be a higher score than your KCUR sports reporter just said. I think it'll be, I just don't think the Chiefs leave that game without scoring at least four touchdowns. So
yeah.
I think it'll, but I still think it'll be close. I think it'll be more like 30-27.
Okay. And let's go in favor of the Chiefs, you're saying.
Of course.
Yes. Well, you had 12 years in the U.S. Senate to fix the Chiefs' playoff problems. And, you know, come on.
Well, I have more time now.
Well, there's so many things to ask here. You've just finished your first week as a former senator. A lot of people will wonder, how are you doing?
You know, I'm doing great. I hope people know me well enough, especially in Kansas City, where I kind of grew up in public life.
Yes, you did.
That I have always tried to be really candid, and I think people know me well enough to know that I'm competitive and I hated to lose. And there are parts of this week that sucked. But I have a newfound freedom, not only in terms of my schedule, but also in terms of opportunities that are out there that I intend to take advantage of. And I'm by far a long distance from putting my feet up. I've got to move the needle on things I really care about. I feel very strongly about mentoring and helping candidates in Missouri. I will not buy in to this notion that Democrats are done in Missouri. I disagree with it. I think it's wrong. Hmm. I think it's people who don't have the perspective I have of history, where this pendulum has swung back and forth a number of times over the last 50 years in Missouri. So I've got work to do, but I'm having to get over, like, what I'm tweeting. You know, I've always just tweeted myself, right? Uh-huh. And I've never been edited. I've never shown my staff before I tweeted, and it's gotten me in trouble sometimes. But I've tried to be cautious, and so I find myself typing these tweets and thinking, well, should I? And then I remember that I'm not running and I'm not in office. I go, what the hell? Send it, right? So I think I am going to be a little more free to kind of let loose with some of my strongly held opinions, even though I've not held back a lot in my career. Yeah. I have held back some, and now I won't hold back at all.
What are you going to do next? I mean, you said you're going to stay engaged here. Where are you going?
Well, I wish I could announce on your show, it would be an appropriate place and time to do it, what I'm going to do next, but I can't yet. But I at least for part time, I anticipate that I will have a place that I'll be able to speak out and talk about what's going on in Washington and in this country. And so that should be announced sometime in the next couple of weeks. And you can, but that won't be full time. And so I'm looking at some other things. I'm going to do a little bit of teaching in February for David Axelrod up at his Institute of Politics at the University of Chicago.
Wow.
I'm going to spend 4 weeks up there. And I want to take a look at what they do there. I'm interested in trying to help facilitate a program at the University of Missouri that would focus on modern-day journalism in politics. If there's one thing I've seen change, it is how politics is covered and or not covered. And some of that is the cruelty of the economics of journalism right now.
Right.
Some of that is the rise of social media and how much information is out there that has been unedited and many times is tortured when it comes to the truth. But I do think it's time, and with us having such a good J school in Missouri, I think that would be a logical place to begin to have some more high-level conversations about journalism in the future and what changes have occurred and what should we be doing to protect our democracy, because the freedom of the press, to me, is the most essential ingredient to the health of our democracy. And I'm really worried about it. And so I'm interested in working on that at least part-time also.
Did the defeat take something out of you?
You know, I don't think I would put it that way. I feel very good about the campaign we ran. I feel very good about what we accomplished. I feel very good about my time in public. I don't think so. I think it's just a different chapter. It's just a different, I'm going to have an opportunity to do some different things. But I don't feel morose or depressed. I mean, Steve, we had over 280,000 donors to my campaign. The average contribution was $56. We raised just shy of $40 million.
Yeah.
And we did better than any Democrat has ever done in a midterm in the history of our state. And our turnout was amazing. We actually turned out in the Democratic areas of Missouri. We performed better than even Koster and Kander and Clinton. We got a higher percentage of the vote in those Democratic areas. The turnout was much higher. It wasn't that we didn't do what we needed to do. It was the other side spiked. And that was really three things. It was the optics of the caravan. It was the optics of the Kavanaugh confirmation. And it was the camping out of Donald Trump in our state. And those three things got all of the reddest parts of our state off the couch. And they turned out in record numbers. So what was going to be an advantage of enthusiasm that we had, and frankly, that was holding true up until the Kavanaugh confirmation chaos, we were running in double digits ahead of Republicans in terms of enthusiasm about voting. And then their side spiked, and obviously, that's what happened in November. More of them live in Missouri than us. And so it's a matter of who's enthusiastic about showing up. My advantage up until September was we were more enthusiastic about showing up. And we did. But they got motivated. And rural Missouri just swamped us.
So a month out, did you have a sense you were in trouble?
I had a sense we were in trouble the day Kennedy resigned.
Really? Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because you knew what that was going to mean in terms of ginning
Correct.
Up the base. Yeah.
Correct.
Yeah.
And I knew that, you know, all my opponent wanted to talk about was the court and the social issues that are associated with court decisions. And
that's catnip for conservative Republicans, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And rural Missourians. So I knew the day he resigned, it was going to be trouble. And then when the whole thing happened with Dr. Ford and the way that whole thing was handled, really hurt anybody who was an incumbent. And that's the other thing I should mention. You know, one of the things, I've had a really good run, and there's one place that experience is a real problem, and that's if you're running for office. It's one of the few careers where the less you've done it, the better off you are in terms of being successful.
And, well, I can't help but notice that some of your comments post-election were a sign of frustration, at least to me, over how you think what politics has become. You know, you moved your way up the ladder so methodically. State rep, Jackson County legislator, Jackson County executive, state auditor, and then U.S. Senate. Today, lots of candidates might qualify as these bright, shiny objects, as you referred to Congresswoman Ocasio-Cortez. They have no experience in politics, and yet they get elected to high office right out of the gate. Do I see that right?
Yeah, I think the cynicism that the dysfunction that we have right now has bred in this country has, Trump wasn't stupid when he started using the phrase drain the swamp. There is a sense, and this is not new in history, but it is certainly more acute now that, I watched a focus group of independent voters, and they basically said, you know, we kind of like her. She's smart. She works hard. We think she gets things done. But, you know, she's just been there too long. She's just been around too long. It's just time for something new. And, I mean, that's hard because my time as a prosecutor and my time as an auditor made me a much, much better senator. My time in Jefferson City made me a much better senator.
But that's lost right now.
That's lost right now. I always made the joke in my stump speech. Can you imagine if they were wheeling you into the operating room and the nurse leaned down and said, I've got really good news for you. This surgeon has never done this before. Well, you'd freak out and go back up the gurney, right?
Right.
But
right.
In politics, that's a really good thing that you've never done it before. And I just don't think, frankly, it's lost on most voters that the years of service actually help make people a more effective member of Congress. So
is that what it is?
Yeah.
Is that what you were saying about the New York Congresswoman again, you know, Ocasio-Cortez? That was your point, if I heard you correctly.
Yeah. First of all, I said, I wish her well. I hope she hangs the moon. I'm excited about the young people that are entering Congress for the first time. I think she's amazing. She's articulate. She's passionate. She believes in what she's saying. The point I was trying to make is that if we don't get anything done, the cynicism just gets worse. I mean, look at what's going on right now. You think anybody in the country right now is thinking Congress has its act together or Washington has its act together?
Right.
It just looks like this is a bunch of kids that can't even keep the government functioning. And the point is that if we don't come together in the middle and lose some of the really hot rhetoric and some of the proposals that are not realistic, and really try to stick to our knitting and move the needle on complicated problems that take compromise. You're not going to get an immigration bill that the new Congresswoman wants. Mm-hmm. You're not going to get one that Tom Cotton wants.
Mm-hmm.
You're going to get an immigration bill that's somewhere in the middle. And I think the skill that is needed to speak to that middle and to be part of that middle is something that is not very valued right now. And that's the point I was trying to make about her, is that, you know, your ideas are terrific, go for it, but, you know, remember that in order for us to get things done, we are never going to get, at least in the next couple of cycles, a 60-vote margin in the Senate.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's not like her district in New York. Missouri is a lot different than her district in New York.
Right.
And I just think she needs to be patient with those Democrats that agree with her on so many issues that are from places that aren't quite as blue as where she's from.
Right.
And not be so critical and so willing to try to kneecap them like she has appeared to be willing to do in terms of coming out in primaries against incumbents and stuff like that.
Senator Claire McCaskill is my guest. So you've mentioned the shutdown in Washington. It appears today both sides more dug in, more entrenched than ever. What's the way forward here? What do you see happening?
Honestly, I think what he's going to do is he's going to declare an emergency.
Yeah, looks like it.
He's going to reopen the government. Then there's going to be a court fight. And the wall, as he has told his supporters that it will exist, won't get built, and he'll say he won.
He'll say he won based on the fact he reopened the government?
No, it doesn't matter what it's based on. He'll just say he won.
Yeah.
I mean, that's what he does. I mean, no matter what happens, he won, right? It's like Mexico paying for the wall. I mean, like, how many times did he say Mexico's going to pay for the wall? Now he's going, no, I never said they were going to write a check. Well, yes, you did. Mm-hmm. Yes, you did. Many, many, many times. So he's going to, I think that's what's going to happen. And I think it will be an interesting court case. And frankly, if the court case challenging him on his ability to do this is not successful, then I think we're in for a new era that worries me. And that is a domination of power by the executive branch, because this is very clear that the president is not getting his way with Congress.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the data that supposedly supports this being a crisis doesn't say it's a crisis. And frankly, there's nothing that's really changed in the data significantly over the last, you know, 3 or 4 years. We have fewer people from Mexico trying to come across the border and more people trying to come from Central America. But the majority of the people coming from Central America aren't trying to elude anyone. They're trying to turn themselves in. They're just being turned away at the ports of entry, so they can't even turn themselves in for asylum. So I think the data will make it difficult for him to win. But if he were to win that case, then what does that mean for...
Why work with Congress, right?
Why ever work with Congress? Then the next Democratic president declares climate change an emergency and begins to unilaterally shut down coal-fired plants without Congress agreeing. Or a Democratic president says gun violence is a national security issue, it's an emergency, and begins taking extraordinary action without Congress as it relates to gun control. I mean, there's a long list of things that could go into this bucket that the president is using to try to have his way when Congress disagrees with him. So I think it is a moment of reflection for our country as to what's going to be the future as it relates to the checks and balances that our founding fathers put into the Constitution to avoid situations exactly like this, the overreach of an executive. Our founding fathers, and that's what's so ironic about the young man who replaced me. He's a constitutional lawyer. And I find it, frankly, stunning that he does not see the constitutional implications of that statute being used this way under these circumstances.
Let me ask you about Josh Hawley again, the new senator from Missouri, a Republican. Today, he's the subject of an investigation into his use of political consultants who helped him run his attorney general's office after he was elected. What do you make of it?
Well, there's so many problems with what happened. I mean, he said on election night, this is the end of the consultants in Jefferson City and the lobbyists. And then he basically brought political consultants into his physical office within a week of taking office. And they were directing state staff. They were advising him on what to wear at a search warrant. It's just jaw-dropping if you look at the documents that the Kansas City Star uncovered. Now there's today a situation where there appears to be no wall and no independence between the NRA and his campaign as it related to some of the buying of advertising. So I hope all these things get investigated. But I got to be honest with you, Steve, I'm really trying as hard as it is. I want to keep my eyes focused on things I really want to make a difference on and not just picking on him.
Right.
Because I think it does look like I'm a sore loser and I'm not, and I don't want to appear that way. So I want to be careful. Believe me, there are some tweets I've deleted about Josh Hawley because I just don't want to be that person that spends my days going, oh, my God, look what he said now. Oh, my God, look what he did now. I'm just not going to let myself go there because I got other work to do.
Claire McCaskill is my guest. 816-235-2888 is our phone number here, or tweet us at KCUR up to date. She joins us from the studios of St. Louis Public Radio this morning. Let's go to some calls. And Chris from Kansas City, Missouri, has a question about President Trump. Good morning.
Hi, Claire. I've I'm a moderate Republican, but I'm a patriot first, and I support all reasonable candidates, regardless of party. And I've liked what you've done. The one question I have, I'm also a practicing psychiatrist, and you can see that Donald Trump, frankly, has a mental disorder, and he meets every qualification for it. 90% of our diagnoses are made by observation and interviews, and we've certainly seen enough of that. I am, because of the high discrimination against mental disorders in this country, no one seems to recognize it in our president. For us physicians out there watching him, it's like watching a man have a heart attack, and no one's doing anything about it. Can you explain to me why no one's actually addressing the true issue, which is his mental health? He's ill. He
right.
needs help.
Chris, thank you. And Senator, you said that privately, Republican senators say that they think the president is nuts, to use your word. Go ahead.
Well, I certainly appreciate the doctor's perspective on this, and I understand where he's coming from. But the problems that the president is exhibiting, the American people saw those during the campaign, and they voted for him.
But that doesn't mean they understood that perhaps he had, as the doctor suggested, perhaps a serious mental disorder.
Well, that is a the doctor can say that. I certainly can't say that. I can say that he behaved way outside the norm as a candidate. He got away with saying and doing things as a candidate for president that I never dreamt we would put up with in this country. I never thought that he could be viable. I underestimated the level of frustration and anger with Washington that he tapped into, and that his supporters now have completely bought in to the notion that anybody who calls him names or anybody who calls him out is the status quo trying to hold him back, and mm-hmm. that it's fake news. And so what we really have here, I understand the doctor says we have a medical problem, but it's manifested as a political problem. And I think what we have to do, I feel a responsibility to try to advocate for and work for candidates that can succeed that would end the Trump era. Now, obviously, in Missouri, Donald Trump won the U.S. Senate race.
Mm-hmm.
I hate to mention his name again after I said I wasn't going to pick on him, but Josh Hawley didn't win that race. Donald Trump won that race. So just as Donald Trump, I think, cost the Kansas folks, the Republicans, I think he cost them the governorship by backing the wrong candidate in the primary, which then allowed a Democrat to be elected governor in Kansas. So I think this is a reluctance of the Republicans to take the political heat they would take for standing up to this president and whatever his infirmities might be.
And you see their discomfort? Did you see it when you were walking the halls of Washington talking to your Republican colleagues?
Oh, yeah. I think that, you know, and some of it is baffling to me. You know, most of them are keeping their head down and not saying anything. If you notice, there are a few of them today saying he should not use emergency powers to do this. That is not the right thing to do. I think Grassley said it. Marco Rubio said it. Ben Sasse every once in a while says something that, you know, challenges the president in terms of. But, you know, you look at somebody like Lindsey Graham.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he's just like, I don't know what's happened to Lindsey.
You've said he's flipped.
I don't get it. Mm-hmm. I don't get where he's gone. I mean, he knows. I mean, frankly, Lindsey is the one who went over to the president and said, why are you giving Erdogan what he wants in Turkey? He's just going to come in there and slaughter the Kurds. And the Kurds stood shoulder to shoulder with us fighting ISIS.
Mm-hmm.
We couldn't have had the success against ISIS without the Kurds' help. And the notion, and that's why Mattis was so upset, mm-hmm. was that the president was going to abandon our allies on the battlefield because this strong man in Turkey talked him into it, and he didn't discuss it with anyone. So now he's, you know, everybody around him is trying to back it up now. You can hear the truck going beep, 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 but they're still pulling people out of Syria without a lot of understanding. I hope the Armed Services Committee has some pretty aggressive hearings fairly quickly.
They're saying they're going to slow down the withdrawal.
Yeah, they may mm-hmm. be slowing it down, but the consequences, this whole thing is really tricky with Turkey and the Kurds and Russia and Iran. You know, he's picked so many fights with people who are friends of ours that there is not enough bandwidth
right.
to get everyone together against the people in the world that really are dangerous, like the Iranians, like North Korea, like Russia, because he's picked fights with, you know, people like France and Germany and Canada.
Well, let's do this, Senator. Let's take a short break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation with Claire McCaskill. We'll talk to her about the 2020 race for the Democratic presidential nomination and who she'd like to see be the nominee. And we'll take your questions, too, 816-235-2888. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we are back. I'm Steve Kraske. This week on the show, I spoke with departing Kansas Governor Jeff Collier about his time in office and his political future. You can catch that conversation at kcur.org/up-to-date. On Monday, we'll be in Topeka as KCUR teams up with the Kansas News Service for live coverage of the inauguration of Laura Kelly as governor of Kansas. We'll talk with lawmakers, bring you the inaugural speech, and look at the issues and challenges the new administration faces. That's Monday morning at 11 on KCUR's Up to Date. Well, this hour we're visiting with Missouri Senator Claire McCaskill, former Missouri Senator Claire McCaskill, about a whole host of issues. Our number, 816-235-2888. Senator, who do you want to be the Democratic nominee next year? Where should the party be going here?
That's a good damn question.
Yes, it is.
I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
I think we have a mob, and right now it's awkward for me because it feels like somebody's asking me to pick among my children because so many of the candidates are close personal friends of mine.
Mm-hmm.
So I think what I plan on doing is what most Democrats, I think, are going to do, and that's sit back and watch and listen. I think we need a candidate who is inspirational. I do feel that it's important that we have a candidate that speaks to the future as opposed to the past.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's, I think it's hard for me to imagine that we could end up with the leadership of our political system, both the candidates for president and all of the leaders in both houses being, 70 or above.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's important that we think about that.
We need to think long and hard about Joe Biden, for instance.
Yeah, and there's lots of things about Joe Biden I really like.
Sure.
I think he appeals to many of the voters that we lost to Trump. I'm working really hard and playing by the rules, and I'm not getting ahead, and I can't afford to retire. And these are white working class voters that had been the heart and soul of the Democratic Party for so many decades, and we lost them.
Mm-hmm.
Joe could help get those voters back. They trust him for all the right reasons. And so he's got a lot that going for him in that regard. He's got, obviously starts out with tremendous name ID. You know, it's really going to be interesting, Steve. I think people underestimate how much individuals are going to have to say about this through low dollar donations. The one thing that changed so much in my campaign this time compared to previous campaigns was this phenomena that I would come to work and open the door and open the cash register and it'd be full from people that gave $5, $10, $20. I mean, I'm still getting mail that I can't keep. We're sending it back to people. Checks for $20, $30, $15. People going online, giving $5, $4. There is going to be a grassroots straw poll through low dollar donations that will speak volumes about who's inspirational. Obviously, Beto, was amazing in that regard. I mean, he raised $80 million through low dollar donations.
Who ran for the U.S. Senate down in Texas, right?
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you raised $80 million he didn't take PAC checks. I did. So, I don't know what his average donation is. Mine was $56. I bet his was closer to $20. And that's an awful lot of money from an awful lot of people who believed in him. So keep your eye on who is raising lots of low dollar donations, because that's the one who I think will end up prevailing, because that's the one that's inspiring people, you know, to actually spend a buck.
Let's do this. Give us a quick thumbnail sketch of some of these candidates that you know them in a way that none of us ever will, who are going to be candidates or already are. Elizabeth Warren, she's already announced her candidacy.
You're going to get me in trouble here, because you know me. It's hard for me not to.
But you know these folks.
Okay. Elizabeth Warren, a smart, focused, sometimes sharp elbows. You know, when we were negotiating a bill, which I thought was pretty important, I saw small community banks disappearing in Missouri. They didn't cause the meltdown when we had the banking crisis. They had nothing to do with it. They weren't making liar's loans. These are small community banks that are so essential in rural and smaller communities in our state. And I don't want to see our country just have five big banks. You know, we only, you know, we have three big defense contractors. We have, you know, four big media companies. I didn't want us to have just five big banks. So I worked across the aisle and did a bill that would help relieve some of the really expensive regulations on smaller banks that were never part of the problem. They didn't ever pose a systemic risk or any other kind of risk. And she got up on her high horse about that, was very critical of all of us. And that to me was disappointing. Candidly, I didn't understand what she thought she was gaining by that. But, you know, so, but she will not be deterred in how hard she'll go for it. And she knows why she's running, and she knows who she is. So she's, and she's effective. Whether she can be as relatable as she'll need to be, I don't know.
How about Kamala Harris, the California senator?
Very charismatic, very likable. She remembers to smile, which I know is superficial and dumb. And people will say, why are you even talking about that? It matters. It matters. You know, think about Tim Kaine. You think of him smiling, right? And smiling matters. And she's, I think there is certainly with our primary calendar, if she is the leading African-American candidate, I think that puts her in a very strong position, because we have a number of primary. And of course, they moved up the California primary, which will be helpful to her. The downside is she's from a very blue place like Elizabeth Warren.
Doesn't get you anything on the electoral map.
Does she, can she appeal to that retired union worker who drinks beer at the American Legion in Wisconsin or in Michigan or in Ohio or in Indiana or Missouri? The Midwest matters to a presidential. We can't win the presidency
without it.
Without winning some of these states. And I, you know, it remains to be seen how well some of these candidates who've never run anywhere where they even had to think about the middle being important.
How about a couple more? Kirsten Gillibrand, the New York senator. You've worked closely with her on sexual harassment legislation in the military.
I think she has the same attributes as the previous women in that she's smart and she's focused and she can do well when she's got her teeth into an issue. She doesn't give up. She's tenacious about that. But it, once again, it's New York. So we've now done Massachusetts, California, and New York. I'm thinking about Jefferson County right now, or Cass County. I'm thinking about the, those suburban counties. We did really well in suburban counties in Missouri compared to previous, I mean, I won, CD2. Which is a Republican, I won
the congressional district over in the St. Louis area.
It's a Republican district. Ann Wagner won. I won that district by 10,000 votes. So I want to make sure that the advantages we're getting in suburban districts are not wiped out by the disadvantages in exurban districts if we nominate somebody who people see as, you know, so progressive that they can't relate to them.
Let's go to some phone calls here. A lot of folks waiting to talk to Senator Claire McCaskill, 816-235-2888. Kenny from Independence, good morning.
Yes, thank you for your service, Ms. McCaskill.
Thank you, Kenny.
And my father was president of the Federal Employees Union, like I said, up here in the 70s through the 80s. And I would love it if you would please... Clearly, McCaskill for president. Please consider it, man, before you make your announcement in a couple of weeks. We love you so much. I'm going to get off the phone now.
What about it, Senator? You going to run for president?
No, I'm not. I'm sorry, Kenny. And by the way, it means the world to me when people, and so many people, it is, frankly, overwhelming to me right now when I go out, particularly in St. Louis and Kansas City, the people who are hugging me and encouraging me. And, you know, it's awkward at times. And it's great. And I'm honored and humbled by it. But I'm done.
Let's go to Frank from Lawrence. Frank, you're on with Senator McCaskill. Good morning.
Good morning. Senator McCaskill, January 19th, a week from tomorrow, is the Women's March again on Washington, across the country, and in Kansas City itself. What do you make of that, and what do you plan to be doing on that day? I'll take the answer off the phone. Thanks.
Yeah, thank you, Frank.
Well, I was there last year, and it was great. I was in St. Louis and did the march. And I actually have travel plans that day this year, but I'm trying to figure out if where I'm traveling to, there will be a march, and I will try to weigh in one way or another. And I'm going to try to get my, I've got a number of daughters and daughters-in-law in St. Louis. I'm going to try to get them out that day to help represent me since I won't be able to be there myself.
Susan from Prairie Village, good morning.
Good morning.
Go ahead, Susan.
Hi, I am just concerned about the 2020 election, and I'm a registered Republican, and I'm supporting every single Democrat that is running, and I voted for every single Democrat that ran. I'm so disillusioned with the Republican Party. And my question is do you see and have hope that the Democratic Party is going to unify and come together and put together the strongest candidate possible to beat President Trump?
A lot of folks are wondering about that, Senator.
Yeah, I think we will unify. But that's one of the things we've got to be careful about. We've got to make sure that we understand who the enemy is here. And I don't mean enemy literally. I mean, that's a figure of speech. Obviously, Republicans aren't enemies. But we need to win back the White House. It's important for our country, for the Trump era to be over. And for that to happen, we've got to make sure that we don't have a circular firing squad. We've got to make sure that the presidential primary process is not so heated and so it doesn't become so aggressive that we end up nominating a candidate that is hampered in their ability to win in November by the primary process. So I'm trying to spend my time when my friends are calling me about this, and whether it's Sherrod Brown or whether it's Amy Klobuchar or whether it's Governor Bullock from Montana, the one thing I say to everybody who I talk to is, remember, the most important thing is to convince people why you would be the best, not why the other guy stinks.
Right.
And if we stick to that, if everyone sticks to trying to sell why they would be the strongest leader instead of trying to disqualify the other people who are running, we will be in much better shape.
Speaking of Amy Klobuchar, Michael's emailed us this. Please ask the senator about Senator Amy Klobuchar from Minnesota, potential presidential candidate. She's a Midwesterner. She's likable. She's a former prosecutor. She's tough. What do you think about Amy Klobuchar?
Amy's one of my best friends. She's great. I think... she certainly would be considered, I mean, all of these people. I mean, look, you know, Amy and Sherrod Brown, both of us were in the same class. We got elected at the same time. I'm very close to both of them. Sherrod won in Ohio. He was the only Democrat that did this cycle. Ohio is an incredibly important presidential state. Amy comes from a state that's not quite as difficult as Ohio. She doesn't have quite as much experience in, you know, the mano-a-mano combat you have in, mm-hmm. in states like Ohio and Missouri and Indiana, and where there have been one Democrat and one Republican senator. But she's terrific. And that's why I say it's very hard for me to pick anybody, because so many of these people are my close friends.
Dan Coffran, the former city councilman, writes us this. Senator, he asks about the wall. There appears to be evidence, he writes, that walls may help in populated areas if supported by law enforcement and surveillance. He asks, are there populated areas on the southern border without walls or with walls needing improvement that can be funded for a lot less than the $5.7 billion the president wants for his wall? And maybe Dan Coffran suggests this is a way to save face.
Well, I think that's been that's why the he hasn't spent the money we gave him last year on border security. And that's why the $1.3 or $1.6 billion, I think it was put in this year. No one is against border security. And frankly, I'm as a ranking member on the Homeland Security Committee, as somebody who's been down to the border, who's gone on night patrol with the Border Patrol agents, I am very familiar with what is needed at the border. And mostly because I talk to them. They need more technology. They need lateral access roads. They need certainly more personnel in the ports of entry, where the president keeps talking about the drugs that are coming over. They're not coming over between the ports of entry. They're coming in through the points of entry. And they haven't even asked for the personnel that they, in their modeling, show they need at the ports of entry. Hmm. So, and there's places that on the wall we've built, there's big gaping holes. And when I drove along it with these Border Patrol agents, I go, well, what's with this big gap here? And what's the pickup truck? And they go, well, we have to sit somebody by that gap in a pickup truck all night. I said, well, why can't you close it off? It's still in litigation over eminent domain for a decade. They are still in court. They can't even complete the wall we have because of ongoing fights about the government taking people's land. Now, imagine the costs of that if we tried to do, 2,000 miles of wall, as opposed to maybe another 200 or 300 miles that might be needed. So barriers are fine where they're needed. But what I could never get the Department of Homeland Security to do is give me a plan. What are you going to build and why? Where's the cost-benefit analysis? All the basic things that taxpayers would expect before any major expenditure of federal money has not been done. This is about him saying, I'm going to build a wall. Now I'm going to build a wall. We need a wall. And kind of distorting the statistics to make it look as if the drug problem and, frankly, the terrorist problem, which they finally realized they weren't going to get away with that, and the crime problem are all attributable to the fact that we don't have a wall from sea to shining sea. And that's just flat wrong. It's not factually correct. The data doesn't support it. And that's what's so frustrating about this. If the president would get off the wall, so to speak, and get on to a let's look at what we need to do to secure the border effectively. And part of that is just getting more judges to determine asylum. Just personnel, surging personnel to address this migrant population, this poor migrant population coming from Central America. Surging personnel to handle these asylum cases very quickly. If they're not granted, then those people go back to their countries.
Right.
So there's lots of ways to address what he's calling a crisis, but he's not interested in doing that. He's interested in a political point that he wants to score.
Claire McCaskill is my guest. David Jay wrote me on Facebook last night, why can't the Senate actually legislate using regular order like most state legislatures? Why is the Senate broken?
Well, this is a door that swings both ways. And so I want to make sure I don't blame the Republicans here. The Democrats have something to do with this also. It began when I first came, in fact, in my farewell speech on the Senate floor, the first year I was in the Senate, I voted on 306 amendments. The last year I was in the Senate, I voted on less than 40. Now, why did that happen? It happened because leaders are so interested in protecting their members from tough votes. The first thing that happened was Harry Reid started filling the tree, which is a procedural move you do to keep people from being able to offer amendments. Well, when Harry did that, the Republicans got mad when they were in the minority, and they started refusing to cooperate. And you have to have cooperation in the Senate. A lot of things work on unanimous consent. So that began. And then Mitch, of course, took it to a new art form when he took over, not even being willing to hold a hearing on Merrick Garland, for example. Mm-hmm. So what Mitch McConnell's interested in, and the only thing he's interested in, is making sure that his members that are up for election in 2020 don't have to take a vote that they could lose an election over. Now, that's so bizarre, because we can't solve tough problems without tough votes. If you're not willing to take a controversial vote, you shouldn't go to the Senate. Mm-hmm. And if you go to the Senate from a state like Colorado or North Carolina or Missouri or Maine, if you're a Republican, you know you're going to have to take tough votes, because you're from a state where no matter how you vote, about half the people are mad at you. So, get over yourself and just take the tough votes and be willing to explain them. And that's what really has happened, is the Senate quit voting. It's like the shutting down the government. The House passed a bill, but Mitch won't allow the Senate to vote on it, because he doesn't want his members to have to deal with a 30-second commercial that Cory Gardner refused to pay the Coast Guard.
Right. Now, I only have a few minutes left here. I wanted to just step back in your career, Senator, and look back just for a moment here. Were there times when you were in Jefferson City working as a state representative from Kansas City where you wondered if your future in politics would be blocked simply because you were a woman? Clearly, back then, you were ambitious, you were driven. I'm just wondering to what extent that was a hurdle you had to overcome.
I believed it, that there was a chance. And I do think this. I think I was careful, and maybe too careful, about what I ran for when. Now, some people would say, wait a minute, you took on the incumbent governor of your own party. Mm-hmm. That's not being careful. But that was, years after I began in politics. I think you look at somebody like Bill Webster, for example. Mm-hmm. Bill Webster served in the state legislature for a very short period of time and then ran for attorney general. Well, as a young woman, I thought, well, I can't get away with doing something like that. Hmm. I'm going to have to put my time in. I'm going to have to prove myself. Hmm. I'm going to have to go about this methodically, because as a young woman, nobody's going to think I'm qualified to do that. So part of it was my own head, that I was worried I wasn't going to be taken as seriously as I needed to be taken,
right,
to hold some of the jobs that I longed to hold because of my interest in particularly the attorney general's office. For
so
example,
you had to move more slowly. I got 15 seconds.
I had to go slowly. And also I had to have a really thick skin and a big sense of humor because as a young woman back in those days, you were there, Steve, you remember?
It was
a different era. And I had to put up with stuff that young women, I hope today in politics, never have to put up with. But it made me stronger, made me tougher, and it allowed me to go 22-2 in a state that I have been so lucky to have an opportunity to work for all these years. I'm blessed and grateful to the people of Missouri beyond how I can even tell them for the time I've had trying to make a difference.
That's Senator Claire McCaskill. Senator, thank you for the time. Great conversation. Appreciate it very much. And we'll be watching closely to see what you wind up doing here.
Okay.
Come back and see us. You bet.
You bet.
Okay. Bye-bye. Be sure to join us on Monday for live coverage as Laura Kelly is sworn in as governor of Kansas. Our theme music is composed by Bobby Watson. We had help this week from Brian Ellison, Linda Scher, Maria Carter, Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, and Devin Davis. Have a great weekend, all. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.